This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. With just 2 weeks left in the Supreme Court term, there are a number of high-profile cases left to be decided. And today, the court released four decisions, including one of three gerrymandering cases it heard arguments for this session. For more on what we got today and what's still pending, we're joined by Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge, a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
So, Judge, as I mentioned, there are a few highly anticipated issues that we're expecting the court to rule on. One of those is gerrymandering. While we did get a gerrymandering decision today, it might not have been the major news we were hoping for. The Virginia gerrymandering case was tossed out, basically because it was a challenge that was only brought by the State House of Representatives. So was this decision more of a whimper than a bang, or is there something we can glean from this as we look to the other two gerrymandering decisions still left to be released?
It's hard to say because this was really a very technical decision. Virginia statutes authorize the Attorney General to bring this kind of challenge, not members of the House of Representatives. So it's a very technical standing issue. It could be that, you know, this is a court that is trying to move things along without there being sort of major fights, and it may be that they know two important cases are coming down the line, so it's costless to toss this out. I don't think it forecasts anything at all.
Speaking of the two important cases that are still pending, North Carolina and Maryland, there's been some new evidence introduced since the Supreme Court heard the arguments. Specifically, these are files from the now deceased Republican strategist Thomas Hoffler. And they could potentially apply to both the gerrymandering cases, but also the case involving a citizenship question on the census. What is the procedure when new evidence is introduced after arguments have been heard? Can it affect the court's decision at this point?
It doesn't come before back to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court doesn't have a procedure to reopen a record, or not an ordinary procedure to reopen a record. It's what you need to do here. But depending upon what happens in the Supreme Court, the plaintiffs could go back in the lower court and try to seek to reopen if the case is dismissed based on newly discovered evidence. And particularly if this is evidence that they should have gotten, but the defendants were somehow remiss in providing it, there may be a way to reopen it. But that would be at the lower court level. That's not a Supreme Court, something that the Supreme Court does. The Supreme Court deals typically with a closed record. Now, the question is whether the judges, knowing what's out there from, you know, being people in the world and reading the newspapers, whether that'll affect how they'll decide it, even though it's not actually before
Interesting.
Them.
So it could still affect their minds or the way they think about it, even though
right.
it's
I
not
mean,
admitted.
You know, whether they shut the door firmly or whether they leave it open, there's an interesting question in the census case about the legitimacy of evidence of intent. And so depending upon what they say, they could make a subsequent motion for new evidence at the trial level more or less likely.
So, Judge Gertner, while we were watching for these high-profile things, there was this interesting footnote in another case today. There was a decision in a case involving double jeopardy, and Justice Clarence Thomas wrote a concurring opinion. And again, he took the opportunity to argue against stare decisis, writing in part, quote, "By applying demonstrably erroneous precedent instead of the relevant law's text, as the court is particularly prone to do when expanding federal power or crafting new individual rights, the court exercises force and will, two attributes the people did not give it." Justice Thomas also argued against stare decisis in a decision earlier this year in which the court overturned a decision from 1979. Do you have a reaction to Thomas's take on the importance or lack thereof of precedent in this ruling today?
Justice Thomas now knows that there are at least two other members of the court who are, for want of a better word, actively seeking to be critical of previous precedent. In other words, when he was alone, even Justice Scalia was not someone who would upend established precedent. Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch are not in that category. Though I don't know whether they have signed on to the following, there is literature with the Federalist Society that says, for example, that a judge that fails to overturn legislation when the Constitution suggests that it should is being an activist judge. Likewise, there's literature, mostly in Federalist Society literature, about how the court should be active in reevaluating old established precedent.
Judge Gertner, so just to clarify for our listeners, the Federalist Society is a fairly conservative legal organization that's had some influence, at least arguably, on the most recent Supreme Court picks. Is that correct?
Right. That's right. And the Federalist Society literature deals with precedent very much in the way that Justice Thomas did, which is, you know, there's nothing special about it if it flies in the face of good law or what the law should be. And that's an overstatement, but it's something along that line. And now what Thomas has is Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, whom he knows are aligned with him on the approach to precedent. And the case that is in the sights of these judges is, of course, Roe v. Wade.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So experts have been predicting that this court would be extremely partisan. And I think when we get to Roe v. Wade, we might see something there. With conservative justices holding a 5-4 majority, there's an opportunity to kind of group up. But that hasn't exactly played out so far the way we thought it might. Let me give you a couple of examples. In the Virginia gerrymandering case, Bader Ginsburg, Thomas, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Gorsuch were on one side, with the dissent being Alito, Roberts, Breyer, and Kavanaugh. And then on the uranium decision, Roberts led the dissent but was joined by both Breyer and Alito. So are we seeing some strange bedfellows? And does this augur that maybe this isn't going to be as partisan a court as people thought?
No, it doesn't augur that. It augurs that in cases that are technical, that admit of a technical resolution, the court will split in unusual ways. But that doesn't necessarily mean that either in the gerrymandering case in Roe v. Wade or in some of the cases that are coming down the line, that you won't see the usual alignment. In other words, the Virginia case was a technical decision. You know, this person had a right to sue, this person didn't. The uranium decision was also arguably technical, and so the usual alignments don't apply. But I don't think it doesn't mean that on the issues that divide our country, those kinds of fault lines, that you won't see a partisan court.
So watch this space on that question.
Right.
Before we move on from the Supreme Court, just one more question. There are some pretty major cases that we expect to get decisions on before the end of the term, later this month. What do you have your eye on?
I think the North Carolina and Maryland gerrymandering cases are critical. It's an area where the court usually doesn't, it's a space the court doesn't usually enter because it's a partisan space, and the argument is that when one partisan goes so far as to distort the process, it raises a constitutional question. So what they do in those cases, I think, will really be telling. I think that's what we need to look for. And it also would forecast, it would have impact on elections going forward. So that's really, I think, an extraordinary case.
Judge Gertner, I'm going to shift gears now. While we've got you, I'd like to ask you at least one or two questions about recent Supreme Judicial Court decisions here in Massachusetts. First of all, the SJC recently ruled that law enforcement has to have a warrant to do what's called pinging an individual's cell phone location, to essentially find the location of that individual. But it did carve out an exemption if there are exigent circumstances, such as danger to the public, threat of suspect fleeing. What do you make of that ruling, and is it important?
It is important. It's really part of all courts' efforts to engage with the new technology. If we restricted the Fourth Amendment, the amendment that requires a warrant, you know, to situations in which police knock down the doors to your home, then it would essentially become irrelevant in the modern world. The enterprise is to say, look at this technology. Is it the functional equivalent of those kinds of intrusions? And that's what the Supreme Court has done with respect to, you know, devices that you put under cars to figure out where they are going, GPS devices under a car, and other kinds of things. It's saying, are they the functional equivalent of the kinds of privacy incursions that the Constitution was designed to restrict?
So, Judge Gertner, we've seen some interesting examples of the various branches of government struggling with how to stay abreast of and handle new technologies. As a retired federal judge, can you give us a little peek behind the curtain? How hard is it for a judge to apply old laws to new technologies as
well,
they emerge?
That's an interesting question. On the one hand, apropos of your question about precedent, it's easy because there is no precedent. You're so clearly dealing with a new situation and the application of old laws to a new situation. At the same time, the question of how you do it is critical. In some cases, you know, there's a split between those who believe that the Constitution, state and federal, has to be interpreted in the way that it would have been at the time of the drafting. And if that's the model, then it's very difficult to make it up to date. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult to sort of figure out what the functional equivalent of breaking down the door without a warrant is. I also found it was interesting. I mean, you understand that judges tend to be older and may not necessarily be in tune with the new technology. There was famously a wonderful moment when the Supreme Court was dealing with a GPS device under a car that Justice Roberts leaned over the bench and said, "You mean they could do this to me?"
Interesting.
And it was extraordinary. It was like all of a sudden the new technology and its impact on all of us became clear, and the court said that required a warrant. That was with respect to GPS devices on the bottom of cars. This is related. The Supreme Court, the SJC, has been particularly careful and sort of ahead of the field with respect to the constitutional implications of new technology. So this pinging decision doesn't surprise me.
Well, that's Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks as always for your time with Radio Boston.
Thanks.
All right, stay tuned for more. Coming up, we check in with Massachusetts Senate President Karen Spilka. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.